This is the continuation of the review for the first midterm exam, part 3, finishing the section on affirmative action. Which groups are targeted for special treatment by affirmative action and which aren't? So there are 5 protected classes. That's African-Americans, Hispanic, Asians or Pacific Islanders, women, and Native Americans. Groups that aren't Arabs, Jews, Italians, Irish, they're just considered to be Caucasians, even though they faced historic discrimination in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Let's see. And then what do affirmative action laws say must be done in college admissions, employment, and the awarding of government contracts? And they're different, again, from anti-discrimination laws in that they require you to take positive, proactive steps to recruit, retain, and admit minorities and women. All government agencies and only private businesses who either do over a certain dollar amount of business with the federal government, I think it's $50,000, have 50 or more employees. An example would be advertising in a minority publication for a job. Or having special outreach programs to reach women applicants. So it's taking positive and proactive steps to further minorities in your business or academic institution or government agency. Meritocracy, you have to have a affirmative action plan, which lists all the steps that you are going through to go the extra mile to further minority achievement and women. Meritocracy. So meritocracy is this idea of rewarding people on the basis of merit, as opposed to these other categories, like what group you're a member of, and whether the group's been victimized, and whether it looks like you've had an unfair advantage, and so on and so forth. What unintended consequences did LBJ's Great Society program have? It subsidized single motherhood in the inner cities, and this led to the breakup of the Black family, where you had in poor urban areas, women having children to get government aid, and then not having fathers in the household, because that would mean the government aid would stop. Male children, boys growing up without a father in the household, and engaging in delinquent behavior due to not having a strong male figure in the house. And you add to that the war on drugs, and you had a perfect storm for the kind of urban crime that you see in largely minority communities in the inner city. In places like Baltimore and Detroit and Chicago and parts of Los Angeles. If you account for the higher single parenthood rate, and the fact that more Blacks live in the South, where wages but also the cost of living are lower, what happens to the disparities between the wages between Blacks and whites? Well, they virtually disappear. So similar to the case with women's wages, when you look at women who never married and never had children, they look actually earn more than men. Similarly, if you look at African Americans who aren't single parents again account for the fact that wages are lower in the South, along with the cost of living. Disparities whittled down to almost nothing. Harmful effects of affirmative action policies. In encouraging racial stereotypes, you're trying to stop. So you create this idea that minorities need special help and can't make it on merit. There's always the worry that someone got hired because of a quota as opposed to their actual qualifications. You create resentment on the part of non-favored minorities and also people that aren't part of a minority who present the fact that they're passed over for promotion or admission to college when they have better qualifications than another applicant. And you also encourage people to think in terms of groups and group membership as opposed to treating people as individuals. And those are all pernicious concepts, pernicious consequences of affirmative action. What arguments in favor of rethinking diversity do I give in my article? So there, I make an argument for looking at ideological diversity or diversity of ideas and beliefs and worldviews as opposed to just looking at skin color or ancestry or gender. I suppose that first question is sort of a catch-all for the arguments made in the article. One of the arguments I make is that this concept of diversity balkanizes people. To balkanize means to divide. And so it makes people think in terms of a racial or ethnic identity and then think that they should be partnered with all those people who are of their racial or ethnic tribe and be suspicious of others who are competing against their tribe for various public goods. So the idea is what George Will called the racial spoil system, where people group up with their people of their same ethnicity or race and then are competing against one another. And they don't think of people as individuals, but they think, oh, you're a black person, so you must think like this. You must vote Democrat, and you must listen to a certain kind of music, and you eat these certain types of food. So it encourages the stereotypical thinking, which it says is bad. And then this idea that, well, we're going to divvy out favors or special treatment on the basis of race, and this more firmly entrenches this idea that the most important thing about you is what group you fall into. And so when you're, you know, Frank Ricci, the dyslexic firefighter, and you're told that you're not going to get your promotion because not enough black people got into the top tier, you're probably going to be a little bit resentful. If you're an African-American person and you've been promoted and maybe you hear somebody talking in the hall about, whether you got through in a quota or not, that's probably going to worry you. Or you might even wonder about, you know, whether people take you seriously, knowing that you have institutional preferential treatment that other people don't receive. What does diversity mean in LCC or other educational institutions? Well, basically it just refers to, race and gender and sometimes the disability or, veterans, but it doesn't really refer to diversity of experiences or background or beliefs. It's just looking at this sort of surface diversity. Basically does mean just skin color and national origin. Doesn't mean diversity of opinion or point of view. And if you actually look at college professors as a whole, they tend to sort of think in lockstep. they have very similar views about controversial social issues, about religion, about politics, and this is the Mike Royko says they look like the rainbow, but they all think like NPR, National Public Radio. Problems associated with a racially, ethnically, and culturally mixed society. You do get conflicts, more conflicts than if you have a united or racially homogeneous society. So you don't get ethnicity and culture, you don't get age-old ethnic rivalries and conflicts coming up between ethnic groups. You don't get religious conflicts, conflicts of social taboos, and that are sort of at odds with one another. And so living in a diverse society creates certain challenges that more homogeneous societies just don't have. Everybody agrees on all the controversial issues or agrees more. And that, creates a certain amount of harmony and less stress and less conflict. So this idea that diversity in itself is great and is creates a powerful and cohesive society is a sort of a questionable assumption. That diversity as a goal in itself is a good thing or something we should increase without looking at other things like unity or commonality. So, making people more race conscious and get them to strongly value their cultural identity and see that as sort of the be all and end all of who they are as a person, more deeply entrenches these differences and can create more conflicts. And so I suggest in the article, rather than making people more race conscious and say, pay attention to the fact that you have dark skin or you have an olive complexion or your ancestors are from this place or that place, instead focus on our common humanity, basic human rights, human values, the individual freedom, tolerance, universal human values that everyone can agree with, and treat people equally under the law instead of saying, okay, you're a member of this group, you face this kind of discrimination and in the past and you may face them now, and so we're going to give you preferential treatment. That just sort of sows the seeds for more conflict. So in the long run, which may be prove more successful is to have people focus on their common humanity and these basic values of the values of Western civilization of individual freedom and personal responsibility and hard work and tolerance. Let's see. The general makeup of academia tends to be very left-wing or liberal or progressive. David Horowitz, you can look at the article there. He cites lots of examples to support this view, and lots of studies have been done on college professors, and the academy is fairly lopsided for all sorts of reasons. Mainly, it's always been sort of at the vanguard of social change, but in the 60s, the 60s revolution, happened largely in college campuses. It was caught up with the anti-war movement, the hippie movement, the sexual revolution, and all of these things happened on college campuses, and you had students end up getting degrees, advanced degrees, and becoming the professors. And so all the children of the 60s became college professors, and academia started moving more leftward. You can look at the article by David Horowitz, Missing Diversity on America's Campuses, I think it's called, in the section on diversity on campus. In a nutshell, he says that students get a very one-sided view on lots of issues, that the faculty and the administration are overwhelmingly left-leaning, and this comes out in the teaching, and conservative voices are squelched. And he thinks this violates this and is an offense to the spirit of free inquiry and the principle of free speech in the Constitution, given that these are, you know, government agencies. The National Association of Scholars suggests that it's fine to talk about race and gender, but that shouldn't be race, class, and gender, but that shouldn't be the be-all and end-all, and shouldn't be the main driver of what goes into the curriculum. They suggest that it's good to include the work of non-Westerners or minorities, but that it should be justified by objective reasons, not because we want to make people feel good or we want to make people feel included. It should be on the basis of merit. So if you're going to squeeze out, say, Shakespeare, then you can't sort of say, well, we're going to put in some obscure Chicano playwright who did a revision of Aristophanes, The Birds. And he did The Birds in the Ghetto. And there is actually such a, it's a musical. There is such a work, right? So imagine like kicking out Shakespeare to put this in. And, you know, what you could do is you could have Aristophanes, which I think should be included in any, say, a drama class. And then you might include this other work as sort of, you know, here's a modern take on The Birds. But you should also study The Birds. Let's see, which is where as an aside, where the phrase cloud cuckoo land comes from. So Peter Schwartz argues that the concept of diversity itself is a racist notion, because the idea is that because you're of a certain group, you think a certain way. So this idea that there are white ideas and black ideas and Hispanic ideas, and that people can be reduced to their race. And it treats people, again, as members of groups and not as individuals. Whiteness History Month at Portland Community College. So whiteness it's this idea that we live in a white supremacist culture and that there is systematic oppression of minorities by the white majority, and it's all about educating white people about their white privilege and of trying to raise awareness amongst minorities that they live in a rigged system, to borrow a phrase from the election, and to try to look for ways to change it, which typically, you know, come in terms of more of preferential treatment for minorities and I think minorities in particular. This is just race and not gender. So it's somewhat controversial, even though this idea has been around, really it's a fairly recent idea, since the 90s. On the website they make it sound like, oh, it's been around since the 90s, this isn't a new thing, it's been around a long time. But in academia, you know, the couple of decades isn't very long, and I'm not sure how relevant that is, even is to the argument that it's nothing new, as if that gives an idea credibility. And it's controversial because the charge is that it demonizes people with light skin. And also, you know, makes the controversial suggestion that we live in a white supremacist culture, which I think many people would disagree with, even people of color. So it's part of a sort of part and parcel of this idea of white privilege. It's related to a lot of neo-Marxist understandings of American society, and it's ideologically driven. So it's not just a discussion about race. It's not a neutral discussion of race. It's a discussion of issues of race with foregone conclusions that we live in a racist society, and we need to band together and use the government and social pressure to end white privilege and to by giving more privilege to minorities. Obviously, that sort of idea caused a lot of controversy. And I think this is a good example of the whole diversity bandwagon, how people, pair up on sides. And there's a difference, again, between raising issues of race and focusing on one group and targeting them as the cause of all the world's problems. So that's and that's essentially what the charge is that this whiteness concept does. Okay, that's it for the review. Good luck on the exam. As always, feel free to send me a Moodle message or come by office hours if you'd like some help reviewing for the exam, and good luck.